I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. My guest today, Zue Quoc, arrived in the U.S. in 1979 when, as a baby, her parents fled Vietnam as boat people. They eventually settled in North Philadelphia, where Zue grew up in the midst of poverty, crime, and violence. The trauma of her early years came to the surface while she was a student at Harvard, finding herself among classmates from elite backgrounds who had led vastly different lives from hers. She wrote about her experience in her widely read Medium blog post, Poor and Traumatized at Harvard. Zue turned to neuroscience and meditation in an attempt to deal with her PTSD, developing what she calls mind-hacking techniques to help her brain heal from the trauma that she had suffered. After Harvard, she went on to earn an MBA at Wharton and for 4 years worked in finance in Asia. But out of a desire to, as she says, pay it forward, she returned to Philadelphia and founded Calm Clarity, a social enterprise that uses science to help people master their mind and be their best self. Its mission is to ensure that world-class mindful leadership training is available not only to elite professionals, but also to underserved groups facing extreme adversity. Zue is also the founding chair and executive director of the Collective Success Network, a nonprofit that supports low-income first-generation college students. Zue's book, Calm Clarity, was published earlier this month and has been hailed as an extraordinary work by an extraordinary woman. Zue, what was it like for you when you got to Harvard after growing up in one of the most crime-ridden neighborhoods in Philadelphia?
To say it was culture shock would be an understatement. I mean, even though I was very academically gifted, for the most part, I hadn't really left inner city Philadelphia. I'd been to downtown Philadelphia, but I never really spent much time in the suburbs or around people from much more affluent areas. And so I remember being at Harvard and people would have these conversations that I wouldn't even know how to be part of, like, where was your favorite place your family ever went on summer vacation? They talked about Europe and islands and all these things. And I was like, I'm not able to really contribute here, so let me just listen. Or people will talk about when they first learned to make investments. When did they make their first investments? And I was like, you guys have money to invest? they compared their trust fund strategies and where did their parents let them manage their trust funds. And I was just like, wow, like we come from totally different worlds. And, you know, it got to the point where when people wanted to socialize and go out, like even though, you know, they were open to having me join, I just couldn't afford it. And so I would have to make up excuses to not go along. And after a while, people stopped asking, which was a major relief for me because I didn't know how to keep making up excuses. And I realized the few times in which I did share about my own background, my classmates, their jaws would drop in shock and horror. And I realized that, they really couldn't relate to my experience. And neither did they have the maturity to be able to process it without making me feel like there was something terribly wrong with me and feeling a sense of shame. And so I found it easier to just let people project whatever stories they had on their mind about me rather than to actually talk about my background.
And so you found yourself in this really alien environment with carrying a lot of trauma from your early life. And all of that, it seems, sort of came to the fore during your time there, and you really began to experience symptoms of PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, I think even though I was living in the violence and stress or the toxic stress of being in inner city Philadelphia throughout, my childhood through high school, there was such a strong sense of community. you know, many of my friends were going through the same experiences, and it, I didn't feel like I was alone. I didn't feel like I was special. I just felt this is what we have to deal with when you grow up in this area. And I didn't have a sense of what life among privileged people were like. There was no ability to compare. This was just my life, and those of my friends had similar lives, and that was it. But when I went to Harvard, it was the first time I saw such a huge socioeconomic divide. And even though I had, you know, earned a spot at Harvard, I didn't feel like I was actually welcomed there socially. And there was a sense of alienation that I couldn't really be who I am. I had to, you know, compete with people whose parents were senators, vice president of the United States, the governors, CEOs, you know, people who had vast more resources and networks at their disposal, and I was supposed to keep up with them. I always felt like I was 20, 50 steps behind. I would never, ever understand, you know, what people were doing because it was so beyond, like, the world that I grew up in. And, you know, with that sense of not having social support and feeling alone and disadvantaged, right, I think my inner critic kind of started taking over my brain in a way that it didn't do in high school. And I, you know, began to dissociate. I would have nightmares and flashbacks that would keep me from sleeping through the night. I would have crying spells that I couldn't stop. You know, I couldn't go to classes sometimes. I couldn't drag myself out of bed. I started having panic attack and anxiety over things that, you know, were pretty minor, but I just couldn't pull my sense of confidence together to leave the room. Things would shatter me that wouldn't have to shatter me, but because I was just so, my brain was just so impaired, it was really hard to pull myself together.
Yeah. So you turned to, well, first you sought out a therapist who explained, I take it, explained to you what happens to the brain in trauma. Is that right? Is that what got you on the path of exploring that?
Sure. I mean, what happened was I began to have these anxiety attacks that were out of control. So I took myself to the emergency room and they prescribed Ativan and it somehow helped me. And I thought, well, maybe psychopharmacology isn't such a bad idea after yeah. all. And maybe I should like explore how to get more help. And so I set an appointment to see a psychiatrist, and he asked me to walk him through my life story. And he said, you know, what you went through before you were 2 years old may explain what you're going through now. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, you know, when you experience all that trauma in early childhood, it affects your personality, the development of your brain, your nervous system. I mean, it has long-lasting impacts for the rest of your life. That's what the research is beginning to show. And I was like, really? And it was, I know, it was bittersweet because on one hand, I didn't feel like it was my fault anymore that I was having these symptoms. Like I had no control over all the things that happened to me during childhood, and that it was actually a miracle for someone of my background to end up at a place like Harvard. It was also devastating because there was no real cure for the condition.
Right. So you came away from that feeling like you were permanently scarred.
Yeah, there was a sense that, you know, they couldn't guarantee that these symptoms would ever go away or that I would ever, you know, have a normal life. And I didn't really want to feel like a victim. I didn't want to be disempowered. But at the same time, like, I wanted to know what my options were. And so he explained, you know, there were drugs. He couldn't guarantee that one would work. We'd have to go through different drugs at different doses to see which one was most effective. And then he also suggested I begin therapy. And again, at that time, it was the late 90s, and therapists weren't really familiar with how to treat trauma. And so some of the experiences I had were not particularly helpful.
Yeah, so much has been discovered since then. So before you were two, that's when you were still in Vietnam, you were in a war zone, your family was fleeing as refugees, so you, even before you were probably, well, just beginning, I guess, to be in a verbal state, you were experiencing all of this, that your brain was just taking in all of this trauma.
That's correct. Actually, the war had ended around 1975, 76, but you know, in the aftermath of the war, as, you know, the North consolidated power over the South, people began to be taken away, you know, disappearing in the night. And so many of the Southerners began to flee because they didn't want to wait their turn.
Right. Yes, that's right. You were born just after, shortly after the war ended.
Yeah. And so my parents were terrified and decided it was better to take their chances, possibly dying on the high seas, than to just wait their turn to be taken away.
So then you, after all of that, you find yourself in Harvard, you're experiencing PTSD, you are getting some alleviation from the symptoms through some drugs, but then you want to find a way to heal yourself from this.
Yeah, I was in this situation where I grew up, for the most part, without health care, without health insurance. And I had health insurance during the time I was at Harvard. But upon graduation, and I hadn't figured out what I was going to do after college yet, I would again be without health insurance. And I think I grew up before CHIP was really a thing. And so I had a deadline of figuring out how to wean myself off medication and therapy without relapsing. And given that I was at Harvard and there was vast library system at my disposal, I decided, why don't I teach myself what was happening in my brain, see if I can experiment with different techniques to get myself to stabilize and to break whatever patterns I was locked into that was creating the negative spirals. And if I could do that, there's a chance that I wouldn't need therapy or medication anymore.
So you really turned to neuroscience to understand what was going on in your brain. And then you developed ways to deal with the thoughts that had taken over your mind at that point. Is that right? The inner critic, as you put it?
Yes. So, I mean, I noticed when it would get louder, right? So when I didn't get enough sleep, when I wasn't eating properly, and I read that, you know, you could bring more blood flow to the brain. Like, the brain is healthier if you actually get a full night's sleep, if you eat breakfast, if you work out and you cut out junk food. So whatever you would call good brain hygiene, I started to implement in my life. And I also did some research that noted that, you know, people who were depressed had lopsided brains. So one side of the brain was more activated than the other side. And the side that was activated was responsible for being pessimistic, being darkly realistic about what could go wrong, being very cynical. And the part that was underactive was the optimistic side that could see the possibilities, the joy, the optimism, that could see positive scenarios unfolding. So I had a brain that could only see what could go wrong and had a really hard time seeing what could go right, what could bring me joy. And I decided to try to work out that other part of the brain by watching a lot of comedies and feel-good movies to just try to activate it more. And I remember I was an art major, so for a couple years I was only feeding myself very melancholy film and like very sad, depressing
artwork.
Oh, you
were being like the stereotypical artist, the dark the dark side.
But
yeah,
I was like brooding and all of the darkness of humanity. Right. You know, there's like so many deep and dark like novels, right, and plays and things like
and that's,
that.
And that's real art, and, right?
Yeah, and that was basically strengthening my right prefrontal cortex, but not helping me with the part that was responsible for joy, the left prefrontal cortex. And I was like, you know, I've been doing this to myself for several
years.
Yeah,
I suppose your art professors also would not have welcomed you exercising the capacity to imagine joyful scenarios in your artwork.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I've now realized that different types of vocations, right, will lead to different types of brain activation patterns. So, you know, lawyers tend to see risk and not reward. Same thing with accountants, right? So there are some people who may not have started that way with a very strong right prefrontal cortex over the length of their career because they're exercising that part and not their left prefrontal cortex. They've become way more depressing to be around.
That's very interesting. It makes perfect sense. So you also started exploring meditation. Now, did you, I know after you graduated from Harvard, did you go immediately then to Wharton?
The typical path to business school is that you should work for about 2 to 4 years. So I ended up getting into a management consulting firm, worked for about almost 4 years before I got into Wharton and then went for the MBA. And to be honest, like, I was such a scientific-minded person that my first exposure to meditation in college was so fluffy that it wasn't for me. And I love the neuroscience aspects of mind hacking, but at that point, I hadn't yet connected meditation into mind hacking yet, because it wasn't explained in a way that the neuroscience made sense to me. Much later, it wasn't until about 2009, 2010, when I became exposed to the mind and life dialogues between neuroscientists and the Dalai Lama, that I, whoa, that's pretty powerful. Yeah. If that's the research behind meditation, then it is about mind hacking. I want to understand what this is. And after trying to find, you know, ways to learn about it on the internet that were still too fluffy for me, I decided to take, you know, a year off, do what I call fun employment. I bought a one-way ticket to India from where I was based at the time, Singapore, and just explored different meditation centers in Dharamsala, went on the Buddhist pilgrimage trail following in the footsteps of the Buddha to try to get into his mind and try to understand what he might have been thinking when he gave these teachings. Ended up in Calcutta, where I was exposed to the teachings of various yogis. And it was a fascinating time because I had, by that point, read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. And I was aware about, you know, how he described System 1, System 2, the autopilot versus, like, the pilot. And when I was going through these meditation retreats, I realized what we were doing was rewiring the brain so that the pilot had more horsepower, basically to stay awake and not go to sleep, so that the autopilot wasn't constantly running the show. And when you strengthen your pilot, you could then observe what the autopilot does, all those patterns and habits that have been hardwired into your default mode network, and start to reprogram it and replace it with habits that really serve you and help you express your best self versus just pure reactivity. I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, I'm already a different person after I spent about 1 month in Dharamsala at 3 different retreat centers. And I left Dharamsala like a different person. I was way more calm. I felt so much joy. I felt so much connection with everyone, so much more compassion than I'd ever had before. And I have to confess, like, I was kind of a typical MBA in that I just wanted to get things done. I was very results oriented. And I didn't have that much compassion compared to, you know, missionaries or people who, you know, spend their lives serving, you know, the needy and the poor. I was very much results oriented. And coming out of Dharamsala, I realized, like, the way that I had seen the world, this very objective, materialistic perspective, wasn't really helping me be as effective as being able to connect with people at the heart level and really inspire people to do things because it makes a positive impact on the world and not just because it helps the bottom line.
I'm just wondering if your experience in India was sowing the seeds for the work that you're now doing in terms of helping others?
Actually, the seeds from that started way earlier when I was young. I remember living in the inner city and looking around at all the violence and the drug addiction and the hopelessness and the negativity and wondering, what can I do to break this cycle? And if I can break the cycle, how could I share with people how to do it so more people could break this cycle? Like, I don't want to continue this to the next generation. There must be a way to break whatever is being transmitted back and forth from generation to generation. And, you know, my parents had a lot of negativity, had a lot of fear. They had, you know, a lot of trauma in Vietnam. They grew up during the war. They were born into a war zone. They grew up and became adults, you know, at a time of war. And even now, you know, they're often driven by fear in a way that they don't really understand. That's not really conscious to them. And I inherited all that. And I knew that they were letting the past define their present and their future. And I didn't want to be limited by the past. And so even as a kid, I kept thinking, what could I do, you know, to break out of this box? Right. It felt like a coffin. And I wanted to see the world. I had this dream to see the countries where, you know, my ancestors came from. So I was born in Vietnam. My ancestors came from China. And I wanted to be able to just see many different parts of the world in general and explore anything I saw on TV or in the National Geographic magazine. I wanted to be able to see it in person, right? So that I had this dream that my family kept telling me was impossible. Things like that don't happen to you because you're a poor refugee. No one's going to care. No one's going to give you these opportunities. And I thought, well, you know, what if I still find a way? And every dream I had, they would try to like bust the bubble, right? It was pretty painful. And but I still just always had this hope that I would be able to break the cycle and education would be a way to do it. And so I just invested in my schoolwork and learning as much as I could and graduated at the top of my class. And that's how I got into Harvard, because I think they could see this intrinsic drive and curiosity and hunger, right, to do something more than, you know, to go beyond my circumstances. And even at Harvard, through those desperate, dark moments, I always had this feeling that if I could transcend this somehow, if I could transmute this, then that is something that could be very powerful, right, to share with other people. How do you not break even though the system is broken? When I was at Harvard, I didn't want to assimilate. And that was part of the reason why I felt so alienated, because I could see that this system, even though it was one of privilege and elitism, wasn't really generating happiness. Many of my peers were pretty miserable. About half of Harvard students are depressed, suffering from some sort of mental health issue or crisis at some point during their time at Harvard. And I thought, you know, this can't be, you know, the end all be all. There's not a lot of self-love, not a lot of self-acceptance, a lot of criticism and neuroticism to perform at some extremely unrealistic level at a very young age. And that was part of the reason why I had such a hard time at Harvard, because people weren't that human there. You know, people were trying to be superhuman. People didn't really prioritize a community. And so for me, I always felt like, okay, you have these opportunities given to you. You've got to do something meaningful with it. It's not just about breaking into the upper class and having a huge house and a big car, and you know, like that wasn't where I wanted to go. I wanted to make some sort of impact. And when I applied to Wharton, my application was about creating a nonprofit or some sort of social enterprise in which I would help inner city kids learn how to develop leadership skills and see that they had the potential to make the world a better place, right? That they could be a light in their communities. And so I was just looking for a how. Like, what could I actually build that would make a difference? With Calm Clarity and the Collective Success Network, the message is to own who you are and to see the strengths you bring to the table. And don't feel like you have to be embarrassed to be to talk about your background. And that if you are willing to look at all the lessons you've learned, you'll realize that you're so much stronger because of where you came from. And the roots give you this foundation to build a very successful career.
You talk about Brain 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, and I love the terms that you've given these, 1.0 being the inner Godzilla, and 2.0 being the inner teen wolf, and then 3.0 being the inner sage. So could you just talk about each of those brains, I guess you would say, or functions of the brain, aspects of the brain?
Sure. So all of this comes from real life experience with the inner voices inside my head. I remember in college, there would be these like three different personas inside me, and I would be like just taken aback when they came out, right? So there was this thing I called the inner Godzilla, which was connected to my threat, fight, flight, freeze system. And it would come out whenever I felt like I was in danger, or this person didn't respect me, or, you know, someone was putting me down, or I felt rejected. And it tended to want to fight and smash things, or just withdraw, disappear completely, and not want to be seen. And I was like, wow, like, what is this thing that comes out and takes over me? And I F-bombed, like, students, professors, like it would just come out, you know, I would just get so angry, I couldn't control it. And then there was this other thing I called the inner teen wolf. And it's based on the Michael J. Fox movie. It's like, it's just competitive drive. Like when I was around someone who was competitive and arrogant, I just wanted to kick their ass. If there was some competition, I just wanted to win it, you know, and it was like that type A side of me that could get into this extreme tunnel focus around, like tunnel vision around my goals, and just like work day and night to get something. And then once I got it, I would be happy that I won it. But then all of a sudden, like that happiness would go away, and then I'd have to go chase something else. And then there would also be this voice I called the inner sage, which would help me to let go of the things that were dragging me down, the things that weren't serving me, to help me see these patterns and break them. And that's how, you know, I started the mind hacking, because there was this inner voice that just guided me to see that I was responsible for these negative spirals, and it was up to me to break them. No medication would let me do that. The medication could stabilize me, but if I continued to create the negative spirals, I would still need the medication. If I could stop it, then I wouldn't need the medication anymore.
And what you're talking about in terms of cultivating our ability to be in brain 3.0, that is that mindful state that can make choices from a place of awareness and consciousness, that's a huge shift.
Exactly. And the reason why it's really difficult is that, you know, brain 1.0, this fight, flight, freeze system, right? It shuts down blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which is one of the key structures of brain 3.0. And then brain 2.0 is the reward system, the dopamine system, right? And when that gets like overactivated, it also impairs a lot of the important structures and neural pathways of brain 3.0 that gives you like self-mastery, your braking system so you can control impulses, like all that gets shut down so that you can get that carrot you really want. So it's like you're ramped up for immediate gratification, and there's no control around it. And so in many ways, like when we feed brain 1.0 and we feed brain 2.0, what we're doing is weakening brain 3.0, like you use it or lose it. And so at Harvard, of all places, it was so competitive and so perfectionistic that, you know, I spent a lot of time in brain 2.0. And when I couldn't keep up with people, I couldn't make, you know, the mark, or I didn't get what I wanted, I would then, you know, break down in brain 1.0. And so it was this roller coaster ride. These are two sides of the same coin, because you don't always win.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a lose type of game. And so the only way out is to see a bigger picture in brain 3.0 and realize that you're locked in this labyrinth where you're creating the win-lose situation. You're creating the ups and the downs. And if you can let go of that, then you won't create that situation where you're miserable anymore and you take back your freedom. Because when you chase external rewards, you're giving your power to those rewards. But if you stop chasing them and you define intrinsically your own goals and motivation, then the external world doesn't have as much power over you. And you in fact have the power to co-create. You have the power to question the system, the rules, the rewards and the incentives, and say, like, is this leading us to our best, highest expression of ourselves? And if it doesn't, what can we do to change it?
And that seems like such a critical issue right now, because just in terms of what's happening in our culture, there is so much fear, and fear is being fed. So that brain 1.0 is really being fed a lot. And so what you're suggesting is that we really need to mindfully feed and develop and nurture 3.0. It doesn't just happen. It's a choice that we make.
Exactly. Well, when we do these workshops, we explain that you can think of brain 1.0 and brain 2.0 like lower body strength. Every moment of the day where you walk stairs, you walk to your car, or whatever, your legs are used all the time, and so they can bear your body weight. But brain 3.0 is more like upper body strength, where unless you deliberately go to the gym and, lift weights or you play sports, like you won't be able to lift your body weight. You couldn't do 20 pull-ups or, 100 push-ups. And so, and if you don't work out your arms when you do need to do heavy lifting, you can't do it. And so the same thing with brain 3.0, if you don't regularly take time to exercise, activate it, develop it, and strengthen it, in a crisis, brain 1.0 and brain 2.0 are just going to hijack you. There's just not going to be enough brain 3.0 for it to stay on, because the blood flow will get shut down. And so if you can work out brain 3.0, even in the most stressful crisis, you can keep it on so that, your inner Godzilla and inner Teen Wolf doesn't take over.
And what are some of the ways that you coach people or train people to do that?
So this is why my trip to India was so transformative, because even though I had an understanding of neuroscience and these basic principles, I was still being hijacked by my inner Godzilla and inner Teen Wolf constantly, because I hadn't really developed a system to keep brain 3.0 on. But it was better than it was during high school and college and, my 20s, but I just hadn't figured out how to really strengthen it yet. And then I did that month of meditation retreats, and all of a sudden, I could feel this inner sage was so strong that it was going to be a lot harder for my inner Godzilla or inner Teen Wolf to take over. It was able to hit the brakes, on impulses that didn't serve me. It was able to let me see things with compassion instead of getting really angry and resentful. And so I was just really surprised that in 1 month's time, I mean, these were intensive retreats, though, there was such a substantial change in my personality. And so I decided to try to hack meditations in order to pinpoint different neural pathways in brain 3.0 that should be strengthened actively so that you would have further connectivity into brain 1.0 and brain 2.0 to calm them whenever they get overactivated. And so in the Calm Clarity program, I've hacked the compassion meditation. I've hacked just the mindfulness of breathing meditation, focused attention and open awareness meditation, mindful walking, mindful eating. And when I say hacked, I mean we figure out what are the neural pathways that are involved and how to amp up activity in those areas or help people understand what's going on so they can do it more strategically. So it doesn't feel fluffy. So they really understand which part of their nervous system is being revved up and how that's helping them. And the difference, it's pretty drastic, because there have been participants who have done MBSR or done other type of mindfulness training and said it was interesting, they enjoyed it, but it wasn't very concrete. And then when they did the Calm Clarity program, they were much more willing to keep practicing because they understood better how it benefited them and how it activated brain 3.0.
And that's in your book. So tell us about your book.
Yeah, so the book has two main parts. So the overall book is called Calm Clarity, How to Use Science to Rewire Your Brain for Greater Wisdom, Fulfillment, and Joy. And so part one basically brings or introduces brain 1.0, brain 2.0, brain 3.0, and makes it come to life using my life story. I talk about my personal journey through brain 1.0 and brain 2.0 to get to brain 3.0. And the whole idea is try to humanize it and make clear that these are basically part of the universal human experience. It's not a bad thing that you have brain 1.0 or brain 2.0. It's part of you know, being able to survive is actually a miracle to have these parts of your brain. But under trauma, under different circumstances, they can be overactivated. And if you never really develop Brain 3.0, then you're constantly giving your power away to external factors, right? And then, you know, I tell the journey of how I learned about Brain 3.0 and, you know, how I discovered, you know, this, that these religious spiritual traditions in India weren't just bullshit.
Yeah, they've been exploring the mind right. for a very long time.
And I actually dive into the mystical experiences I had that forced me to revise my own beliefs from being a secular atheistic type of person to now being really open to there being a higher consciousness, there being a universal intelligence that is ineffable and defies human explanation and language. And that, to my surprise, you know, when you develop Brain 3.0, you can connect more and more to your higher self and have these experiences of oneness and collective consciousness that, you know, I thought was impossible. And I've had these experiences. I don't go around saying religion is bullshit anymore.
Yeah. You know? There might be something to this.
before I was just so cynical, you know, that I didn't want to believe. I didn't want to give religious institutions any power. And now I know that there is something to it. And I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater anymore. And then part two of the book is The Mind Hacker's Guide to Shifting into Brain 3.0, where we go deeper into the science and how the nervous system works and the different practices. It's like a toolkit of practices, reflection exercises, worksheets to activate different aspects of Brain 3.0 so you can embody your higher self, which to me is the highest expression of who you can be, and that it's there. It's innately, intrinsically part of us, but because we keep getting derailed by, you know, the inner Godzilla and inner Teen Wolf, we can't hear the voice of the inner sage, which is our inner wisdom, our higher self. And we continue to do things that keep us locked in these self-limiting patterns. But once you connect to this higher self, it becomes a lot easier to break those patterns, to see things from a bigger picture perspective, and really break free of the entanglement that we all experience to the beliefs and identities that we get attached to. And for me, you know, it's really just capturing on paper what I've learned over my life that that I put into practice in order for me to embody my higher self.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm very much looking forward to reading your book, and I'm so delighted that you have put this out into the world. And I also want to say, Zwe, that I have loved hearing the city sounds behind you. It's really great. I can tell you're in Philly.
Yeah. I mean, I share this in the book. Like I created the Calm Clarity Mindful Leadership Program, you know, in an inner city neighborhood in the period that I was piloting it. You know, a young man was gunned down, 20 gunshots, right, basically a block away from my home. My dad was held up at gunpoint a few blocks away from there. So these are terribly traumatic things that go on in this neighborhood. And I made a choice, you know, when I said I really do want to pay it forward to come back. I mean, I had, you know, broken free into, you could say, like upper middle class society, but it just wasn't very meaningful to like party on yachts and have cocktails and, you know, these exclusive events and talk about how great we were because we had money. So I just kind of knew when I was in Asia hanging out with VIPs that it just didn't feel satisfying and that I would have to pursue my original dream. I would have to find a way to do so. And so coming back to the inner city has been very grounding because, you know, one of the first things I realized, you know, I had followed the Buddha's footsteps and seen where he meditated for years trying to obtain enlightenment in this cave and supposedly the trees where he sat. And, you know, these were not luxury resorts. And he was able to find beauty in abject poverty. And even in the inner city, the trees are just as beautiful the sunsets and sunrise and the moon are just as beautiful as at any resort in the world, and as beautiful as they were at the foothills of the Himalayas where I did my retreat. And so I was just like, you know, wherever you are, you know, you're connected to source. It doesn't really matter. Like, I can do this in the inner city. I don't have to be in this upscale, quiet, you know, five-star luxury resort to write a book. It's the mindset you bring. It's the internal environment you bring with you that allows you to make an impact. It doesn't matter what the external environment looks like. The socioeconomic advocacy, I think, is a huge challenge since coming back. Like, it has been hard to see such a huge difference between the quality of life of my friends who have so much money and the quality of life where I come from, that my parents have, that my cousins have, right, and that I've chosen to come back to. And, you know, a lot of people question, like, why are you doing this to yourself? But I feel like, you know, you have to understand suffering to transform it, and you have to really be willing to be in the shadow to bring light to it. And you can't do this from a distance. A lot of reasons why nonprofits are not successful is that you have a privileged elite, you know, serving an underprivileged group where there's a disconnect in culture and background, and they don't really understand the experiences of the people they're trying to serve. And so they come with pretty bizarre solutions that they force the beneficiaries to accept because they don't have any negotiating power. And I didn't want to duplicate that. Like, I wanted the students in Collective Success to have a voice and to inform the programming we do. Of course, there's logistics and other constraints, but we want the students to tell us what they need so that we're not designing things for them that they don't really want. And so it takes a lot of discipline because, you know, when you're talking to donors, like, they don't understand this approach, you know, and it's, you know, when you refuse to follow a model that's broken and you decide to reinvent the wheel because the wheel isn't really serving people. A lot of people don't understand that. But as a social entrepreneur, I find that mindfulness is really important because it helps me see the mindlessness that's in the system and to make a choice to not preserve it, to not participate in it, and to be willing to have the courage to build from scratch because what's in place isn't serving the people in the way that it should serve them.
Well, I am so appreciative of your commitment and the work that you're doing and the book that you're putting out into the world. And Zoe, I just really thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. And I look forward to keeping tabs on what you're up to because it's very exciting and so, so necessary. So thank you again for being with me. And I really want to wish you the very, very best with your work.
Thank you. I appreciate your wanting to introduce my work to your audience and to tell more people about, you know, the importance of developing their brain and shifting into Brain 3.0. One of the things I've realized is from talking to people who are on spiritual paths is that, you know, once you make the effort to change your brain, it becomes much more effortless. And when people take the time to develop the neural circuitry of Brain 3.0 and they can tune into the inner sage, then that sense of oneness and that sense of inner guidance and wisdom, like, it just bubbles out on its own. It's effortless.
Well, people can find out more about your work at your website, calmclarity.org, and they can find your book at probably just about any book store they want to find it in, right? And that's available also through your website.
Yeah, all the information is there. The book is published by Tartar Perigee Penguin Random House, so they've found a way to distribute it worldwide. So hopefully, you know, wherever people are, they can buy it on Kindle or get it from Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, and all the typical bookstores.
Well, thank you again, Zoe, and I look forward to being in touch in the future. And to all the listeners, until next week, peace.